to get the technology going.
Oh, very good. Hello and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. It's Toby Miller here again, and I'm in the elevator of the Canberra Hyatt in Australia with my friend Stuart Cunningham. Hi, Stuart. How are you?
Hi, Toby. Lovely to talk to you.
It's great to be here, and it's an incredible privilege for me to spend time with Stuart after you are away, because I regard him... Where the fuck are we? We've got to get out of here. That was a bad move. Okay, push number
press
two.
Press two.
Press two. Carry on. Don't worry about that, folks. It's an incredible privilege for me to be with Stuart because, as many of you will know, he is one of the foundational figures of cultural studies, even though he now, of course, abjures it.
Okay, we're doing well.
Don't panic. You've got to find a quiet spot. And what I'm hoping we might be able to do today to our three men and the dog in Stockholm, who are our very loyal listeners, is chat a little bit, both about the things that matter to Stuart now and what he's working on, but also part of his intellectual, cultural, political formation. So, Stu, why don't you tell the three men and the dog in Stockholm in the clearest English you can muster, because the dog in particular is only vaguely bilingual, what it is you're working on right now?
Well, thank you. Thank you, Toby.
For the great introduction.
Thank you very much. And also to the three men and a dog, I say a hearty hello.
So,
what am I working on right at the moment?
Yeah.
Well, I've been working on the question of the relationship between cultural policy and the broader field of innovation policy and the strange lack of relationship between those two and the beginnings of some reasons why they may be related. The problematic is a well-known one for anyone who may have read Nicholas Garnham's critique.
Brackets, of withering, unbracket.
Nicholas Garnham's critique of the creative industries moment in Britain. This was an article he published in 2005 in the International Journal of Cultural Policy, in which he identifies the major problem with creative industries as being that it is borrowed on the prestige of the information communications technology, information society discourse, and in doing so has suborned the true legacy, the true values, the cultural values which are embodied in cultural studies, cultural policy, and a left progressive account of culture and communications. Since that withering critique, I've been working hard to attempt to answer it, I suppose, to address it, and one of the ways has been to argue that Garnham's focus is a peculiarly Britocentric, UK-centric account of a quite powerful top-down discourse in policy dating from the early years of Blair. But when you look at the ways in which creative industries has travelled to other parts of the world, you see very different configurations, alliances, politics, and reasons for its development.
Could I interrupt for a second there, Stuart, just in terms of familiarity of the three men and the dog with some of these terms. Could you give us a quick account of what is meant by cultural policy, innovation policy, and creative industries?
Yeah, well, cultural policy is that reason. I would think reasonably well known for this listenership set of practices, governmental practices, which seek to govern, support, regulate culture usually at a national jurisdictional level, but you see it as well at subnational and at supranational level with bodies such as UNESCO. But most of cultural policy is enacted at a national level or a subnational level, and is typically concerned with matters of broadcasting regulation, of arts subsidy, and in some of the new digital realms, support for the development of digital arts and digital culture, etc. Creative industries is a category that was probably invented in 1994 in Australia, but was taken up and reinvented with impact in the early years of the Blair government in 1997. It brought together the arts, the media, new media, and design and architecture in a new configuration, which was claimed to be a much larger sector and a much more economically vibrant sector than had hitherto been thought. And from that late 90s time onwards has been controversial in terms of why that sector should have any coherence, and why it should have why those of a progressive persuasion should be at all interested in it, a la the discussion that I have just begun in relation to the Nicholas Garnham critique. And with innovation policy, well, innovation has been a buzzword that has grown in the last, essentially in the post-Keynesian, after the breakdown of the Keynesian settlement in the West in the 1970s, with the combined effects of stagflation and the oil crisis that led to a reconsideration of the Keynesian consensus amongst many Western economies, there was a rethinking of what led to growth in capitalist economies, and we saw the re-emergence of theories of endogenous, that is, internally derived or internally driven growth. One aspect of this was the idea of innovation being a hallmark of capitalist societies through a process of continual, in Schumpeter's terms, creative destruction that lends capitalism its vitality but also its great fragility and potential for damage to the citizens of countries in which it is operating. So innovation is, and innovation policy is, an attempt to focus on what drives change in advanced capitalist countries and how the state can have a role in setting the innovation system in such a way that its benefits outweigh its disadvantages for citizens and citizens and consumers and firms in capitalist societies which have gone through that process that I earlier referred to of the post-Keynesian period from the 1970s onwards. And obviously we've, in the global financial crisis that most countries in the West have faced from 2008 onwards, there's been a significant reconsideration of the macro settings for these kinds of societies when some of the consequences of a post-Keynesian economic philosophy has held sway.
Well, that's great, thanks. So the prevailing assumption in all of this is that the state is crucial to the cultural belonging of cultural policy, the expansion of this notion of creativity, and also the possibility of this kind of innovation. It's got to be there to create opportunities for capital and sometimes tell capital what would be sensible to do.
Well, there is a very... I mean, Toby, your experience of working and living in the States, in the United States, the last 20 years has given you a very strong sense of a society which, though it eschews a heavy-handed role for the state, we know that the state is a very powerful actor in the US, in US society and economy, but is in many ways disavowed. The great stateless society is one of the cliches that is applied to the US, to US society. Most other jurisdictions, most other national jurisdictions in the world perceive the need for a role of the state that is welcomed, expected, and embraced to a significantly greater degree than public discourse of a demotic kind in the US. So my interest in policy, which usually means, and for me usually means, government-based action, public action to shape, to design markets, to regulate markets, to subsidize citizenly activity, to operate as a buffer, a regulator, a shock absorber of global economic forces. These roles I see as being positive roles, and that's why I tend to focus my energies on the contemporary rationales for and new fields of action for the state in the realm of culture.
Mm. So, and getting back to Garnham, I guess the one criticism you're making of him is that it's too focused on UK history and not inclusive enough of the broader swathe of creative industries, discourse and policy and programme. Could you say a bit more about that?
Well,
I interrupted you when you were going to tell us.
No, that's fine. I think it would be of interest to listeners who are perhaps in different parts of the world to, little plug for myself here, an article I wrote in reply to Garnham in a more recent issue of the International Journal of Cultural Policy, in 2009, an article entitled "Trojan Horse or Rorschach Blot: Creative Industries Discourse Around the World." I take as my starting point the argument that I've summarised of Garnham's, that creative industries acts as a kind of discourse acts as a kind of Trojan horse, I call it, for our foreign body, that is, the information society discourses that he identifies with de Solla Pool, with Schumpeter, have acted, creative industries discourse has acted as a kind of Trojan horse, bringing those foreign bodies inside the city of culture. Now, instead of that model, I suggest that it is more like a Rorschach blot, that is, that in its passage around the world, and I identify six different broad models, spatially specific models of creative industries uptake in different parts of the world, Europe, United States, the Global South, Australasia, China, and other parts of Asia. And I suggest that the diversity of take-up, to give a concrete example, the idea that it introduces a foreign technocratic account of culture in places like Singapore and other parts of East Asia, it does exactly the opposite. It's actually a discourse under which regimes like those in Singapore are attempting to introduce a greater cultural sensitivity into a predominantly technocratic polity. In a place like the United States, the only purchase that creative industries discourse has is at a state, that is, at a subnational level, and it operates similarly, that is, as a way of introducing a rationale for cultural intervention by state governments in a country in which, at a federal level, there would be no truck or very little truck for such activity. So I make the argument that policy discourse is not reifiable in the way that Garnham has done, I think, and in that way I try to loosen up the I suppose de-reify the arguments that are made. Overwhelmingly, the arguments that and the debates about creative industries are conducted by political progressives in the UK, for whom creative industries was classic top-down spin by a government that came to be reviled by the broad left in Britain, and the whole creative industries line was by and large caught up, and the critique of it was caught up in that broader turn against Blair and Brown by the broad left in the UK.
Well, thank you, Stuart. You've given us a fantastic explanation of these things that are currently exercising you and your part in them. I wonder if we could go back, like they say in baseball commentary, when a ball is maybe heading out to left field and it's deep and the guy in left field is running back with the glove up, hoping to catch it. So tell us how you got to where you are. So we're having this interview just after, in fact, in a sense, during these terrible floods in Queensland, where you live. and you've lived through those, and you've also lived through the last time they happened in the mid-1970s. At that time in your life, you're finishing up, I think, a history undergraduate degree at the University of Queensland in Brisbane. Is that right?
Well, that does. That certainly is back. So, and you're absolutely right. I was completing an honours degree in English and History Honours.
A double honours.
Well, I started doing a double honours degree, and I actually had to complete one, but not both, because you couldn't do both in 1 year. So I actually opted for the English rather than the history.
And we believe this was a time...
Where can this go?
Well, this I think it goes line to the, doesn't it go to go? The head in the oven? Isn't Sylvia P a major figure in the honours experience?
Indeed, yes.
The head's in the oven, the oven door's closing, the entire kitchen has had plaster placed around its edges so the children are to be protected, but no oxygen can come in.
Yes, well, I did my honours thesis in a conventional literature department on Sylvia Plath, and yes, it was probably quite a courageous topic to take up, because at that stage there had been little settled literary criticism on Plath. There had been some very powerful memoirs particularly by A. Alvarez on Plath, and I found the poetry mesmerising, particularly the last years. The poetry in the last year of Plath's life, and found the whole, if you like, Plath myth of the suicidal poet, the acme of the romantic conception of the poet, a very powerful myth to deal with, and found myself committing what I considered to be the three greatest poems, and indeed three of the great poems of the English language, to memory as part of my honours thesis. And today can still reconstruct good swatches of them.
Which three are they?
Daddy, Lady Lazarus, and Fever 103.
Now, Stu, this is a point at which we should intersect the conversation with the fact that a little later in time, Stuart became the author of two slender but well-received volumes of his own poetry.
Well, that's true. There is a a moment of authorial enthusiasm.
And can we share with the group, The Three Men and The Swedish Dog, the titles of those slim but well-received volumes?
Well, it may be rather difficult to Google these because if they are out there, I'll certainly try to suppress. But no, one volume is called Largesse, Assorted Poems, and the other volume is called Daily Processional.
Right. And I should say, those of you who have a chance, and Stuart's work has also been anthologised, these are wonderful pieces of work. So, okay, you're interested in Plath, you're interested in poetry, you write this thing, you finish honours. There's then the question, perhaps in the floods, perhaps with Greg Chappell having just moved from South Australia to Queensland as the new latest and failed saviour of Queensland's pathetic attempts to win a Sheffield Shield, there must be some sense of, am I to look back or forwards or sideways? And what does that mean in terms of where I proceed?
Mm. It's a very, very interesting question, because I've had cause to think about this recently, because what for me was a completely unstrategized but wonderful opportunity came about through the rapid expansion of higher education that was going on in Australia and indeed in other parts of the world at that time. A new university was being created from the ground up in the place I lived in Brisbane. Its name was Griffith University, and along with other universities created at the same time, Murdoch University, which you, Toby, spent time at in the 1980s and 90s, along with Deakin in Geelong in Victoria, and others. It was a moment that, when we look back from this point in particularly in Western countries, approaches to higher education where massive cutbacks, great crises are being faced in higher education, even as the Asian tigers and other parts of the world are investing heavily in higher education. Going back to this period in the 60s and 70s when whole new institutions were being created from the ground up, the level of policy boldness, the level of confidence in the value of higher education and the demand for it in that period of time was a tremendous time to be attempting to start a career.
So you moved from what presumably is, as you just said, a fairly conventional literary critical training mixed with what I'm assuming was a fairly empirically oriented, or empiricist, one might say, historical training, to a place at Griffith where the whole thing is interdisciplinary. I also taught there, though, some years later when Stuart was there, where the idea is that problem solving is the focus of teaching and research rather than disciplinary parthenogenesis.
Well, right? Yes.
Problem solving from a very theoretical...
Let's be concrete about this. One of the hallmarks of the undergraduate education I received was, no, you will not study any literature after 1900 unless you are lucky enough to do a final year honours year, because you must start at the start and go seriatim through the periods of English literature, and it's hard to describe really, but the extreme conservatism, the lack of theoretical or systematic knowledge that was ever assumed that one could gather from a literary training, a literary critical training, the hidebound nature of those literatures that were considered worthy of attention.
I've got an idea. Let's walk to your room as we talk, and we can get you some water, because you're suffering. We don't want people to suffer in the podcast, lest it upsets the dog. Who knows what frequencies have been attained by your coughing as you attempt to continue on your devastating critique of a period-based analysis of the history of English literature. We follow the Please Mind the Steps sign. We're making our way through the Canberra Hyatt towards Stuart's room. And if we can just liquefy that throat a bit, I believe we'll be able to continue this podcast with very, very minimal interruption. But what you're hearing is clearly the setting to Stuart's decision to write about Plath whilst at the University of Queensland, to write about a woman writer, to write about a writer of the 60s, must in itself, in a sense, have been not exactly a revolutionary act. Thanks, Ogboy. We've entered Stuart's room now.
but at least one that raised questions. And then, of course, what happens is, I think I'm right in saying, if I can anticipate things a bit while Stuart has his ecologically unsound bottled water, is that fundamentally, why don't you sit down over there, sit down on that nice little chaise longue, I'll bring this little chair over. Stuart gets a job at this new interdisciplinary university, Griffith, also in Queensland, that is attracting a different kind of student and is, as he says, emergent at this point of great possibilities of higher education and the possibilities, too, getting back to our earlier conversation, of state intervention to make life better for people. Yeah? Is that reasonable?
Well, yes. I mean, what I wanted to start by saying was the role of the state that you asked about earlier, implicit in your question is that I take it that it's that state action is a far more problematic good, or a far more problematic thing to be established as a good, having lived 20 years in the great so-called stateless society. Now, my initial reaction to that is that, well, it's the US that's the exception, is the exception here, not the rest of the world. There are active states, and those which the richer the country becomes, the more active the state becomes. We know this from both empirical and straight empirical understandings of the percentages of GNP generated by the state, but also in perhaps more alluring ways in the Foucauldian account of governmentality, where the role of both self-government and of the government multiplies, complexifies, becomes more and more layered in as societies become modern. But to come back to the specific question of higher education, that moment of expansion that you see in many Western countries in the 60s and 70s is being replicated now in other societies, even as higher education comes under huge pressure in the West. So to just go back to my personal history there, going into as a neophyte 21-year-old into a completely new university.
And not as a student, but as a faculty member.
As a what would be called in the States a teaching assistant, but in this case a full-time teaching assistant, not a grad student jobbing on the side. So a full-time teaching assistant, teaching and not researching, but being enormously stimulated by an environment that that put me into team teaching with very, very experienced academics, some of whom were coming to the ends of their careers, some of whom were in the middle or earlier, but working with historians, anthropologists, art critics, film producers, an extraordinarily fertile team environment where curricula was developed collectively, delivered collectively to small groups of students, as Toby says, in a problem-solving context, interdisciplinary, even anti-disciplinary in some ways, because the discipline bases were rarely... it wasn't a case of beginning in this problem-solving way and then moving into disciplines. It was a case of the whole curriculum being based around interdisciplinary approaches to problems as were perceived to be important problems at the time in the world.
So you're there, and this is a transformation, and no doubt it's part of a transformation that takes you over a much longer period from talking about Sylvia Plath to talking about Keynes and Schumpeter and Foucault. But you don't stay there very long. You then decide you will become a graduate student in the North American idiom.
Well, yes, and again, the opportunities that I were made available to me, I think of them as being historically not unprecedented, but certainly I was the very fortunate recipient of career opportunities during the great upswing of higher education in the West. I was able to secure a scholarship specifically for overseas study based upon the idea that what I wanted to study was not available in a good enough, well-established enough graduate program in Australia. And in fact, it was called the Captain James Cook Travelling Scholarship. Captain James Cook, for those who don't know, was the British white man who is held to have discovered, that is, have navigated the east coast of Australia for the first time. The Dutch had done a lot on the west coast of Australia well before Cook, but because the British then colonised Australia, Cook becomes the key explorer, and so I travelled with a James Cook travelling scholarship to Canada and did a master's degree at McGill University in communications, very much in the Canadian communications tradition, but also had developed by then a very strong passion for film and film studies, and did a master's thesis on Frederick Wiseman, and went off from there to the University of Wisconsin-Madison and to study under David Bordwell, who was at that time in the midst of the mammoth research project that he, Kristen Thompson and Janet Steiger were engaged in, that became the classical Hollywood cinema film style and mode of production to 1960, which was published in 1985, but which they were well into the research phase of when I was there.
And as I recall, he made you particularly welcome after you'd been there a short time. Was there anything special that he said to you?
Well, he said I should go home.
Did that encourage you at all? In any direction?
Well,
back.
I was a fairly recalcitrant student who, because I had taught full time in a university for 3.5 years before I became a graduate student, thought I knew everything, and probably was quite a pain in the arse for perhaps I hadn't learnt the codes of graduate student conduct sufficiently well.
Submission to the master. So you're there, you've gone from literature and history at UQ to Griffith Interdisciplinarity to Canadian Communications at McGill to US Film Studies at Madison. You've been made spectacularly welcome by the doyen of formalism, diluted by some interest in content analysis and a kind of crude political economy, done by other people, really, in the book you've just referred to, where does that lead you? Suddenly you're in your mid to late 20s, you've got the BA, the James Cook Travelling Scholarship to reverse the white settler colonialism, the MA from McGill, you've landed at the Great Lakes. What happens to you then?
Well,
your ABD or
well,
bar dissertation?
Or perhaps unlike those who've availed themselves of the American, of the US graduate experience, I didn't finish it. I returned for family and personal reasons to Australia and took up yet again a jobbing junior position, full-time junior position at Griffith, working hard in delivering teaching programs and trying to complete a thesis which began life in Madison as a study of applying René Girard's theories of mimetic desire and triangular desire to New Hollywood. When my intellectual stimulus for this was by my moving to the other side of the world was somewhat dissipated, I then took up a completely different strain of work on Australian film history and finally completed a PhD using that was certainly had had some indebtedness to David Bordwell. I used the notion that he develops in his work on European filmmakers, the so-called biographical legend, and I applied this to an industrial biography of a of an Australian filmmaker, Charles Chauvel, and that was a very detailed empirical work on industry history, but was informed by world systems theory, accounts of Second World nation status, and to close textual analysis methodologies as well. So it was an interesting attempt at integration of some of the newer and dominant modes of film studies at the time.
And this, by the way, is Stuart's first book of prose. It's called Featuring Australia. It is about this cinema of Charles Chauvel. And it also is also trying to get at these questions of cultural nationalism and how appropriate they are.
Well, so that's right, and I must interpolate at this point that Toby is the person who suggested the title for this book, a most appropriate title, and one for which I'm always grateful to him.
So, anyway, the point is, it is a terrific book, by the way, and those of you who don't know Charles Chauvel's work, a lot of it is really worth seeing, and the debate Stuart addresses about cultural nationalism, a concern with this filmmaker who worked in Australia, worked in Hollywood from the 20s,
To the 50s.
Last thing he did, I guess, was a TV series in the late 50s. It is a terrific book, and it does raise a lot of interesting issues about this biographical legend and others. Now, I'm conscious we've only got a quarter of an hour left, and the old boy's flagging, but he's hanging in there. We've made it to about 1990, and this is when, roughly, it seems to me, mimetic desire, Girard, psychoanalysis, poetry, things of youth are suddenly put behind. And instead, the world of, in a sense, the social sciences applied to culture becomes more significant for you, and the armchair radicalism of the textual analyst ceases to be of great appeal, and you, in fact, take a professional shift that isn't just an intellectual shift, or an intellectual shift that isn't just a professional shift, whatever it may be. And at some point here, you go way on down south, don't you? As
yes.
The actress said to the bishop.
Well, that's a good intro to the question that I, for reasons that are interesting and somewhat obscure, but mostly driven by a desperate need to get out of where I was, I took a job as a policy advocate and analyst in a not-for-profit NGO, non-government organisation called the Communications Law Centre in Sydney, and this was headed by a very dynamic Labor lawyer, and I entered a related but very different world. Related in the sense that they were interested in me because they were dealing with questions of film policy. The job I got was funded by the Australian Film Commission. It was prepared that the commission, a film funding agency, was prepared to fund the law centre, the Communications Law Centre, to conduct research and advocacy around film policy, around broadcasting policy, around copyright, around a range of issues that were at the time pressing ones for the film and screen industries in Australia. And out of that came I suppose in some ways it could be seen as a paradigm shift, but certainly the industries of focus remained the same, but the approach became much more one of policy reformism rather than what you have somewhat helpfully for me and perhaps disingenuously for you called armchair radicalism. Essentially, I saw and observed and participated in the idea of policy advocacy, contributions to the policy process through critique of government action, of corporate action, and saw a politics in that of a sort of social democratic politics of reformism that I probably to this day regard as the kind of politics I want to engage in, and which I attempted to distinguish from an academic politics of revolutionary radicalism in a book called Framing Culture, Criticism and Policy in Australia, and which was, when it came out in 1992, a quite controversial book which attracted reaction from and mostly criticism from many of the leading academic cultural critics at the time.
And some of that book derives from your experience at this Communications Law Centre. I think there are bits of it that are about
inquiries
that the government was holding into the relationship between violence on television and violent effects in the society, and questions of cultural nationalism and quotas for TV, not just things like drama but advertising and so on.
Yep.
However, at the same time, pardon me, that this influence is coming out in your work, you're also part of and become a major spokesperson for something else going on again at Griffith, even though you've left Griffith by now, right? Because it had now transformed itself from the cutting-edge insurrectionary interdisciplinarity of the 70s into the King's Counting House of cultural policy reformism. No? So you, in fact, were once again part of and both influenced by and influencing something there, because there were some of the same people you'd worked with in the past and some new people who were also interested in this turn away from a revolutionary negation and refusal of the the state, capital, and so on, into a social democratic embrace and desire to transform.
Well, yes, I mean, you know, you're referring to Tony Bennett and Colin Mercer, Gillian Swanson, to some extent as well, the influence of the more theoretical influence of Ian Hunter, the idea of cultural policy being a direction into which cultural studies should go was certainly shared by all of those people, me included, and an Institute for Cultural Policy Studies I participated in, based at Griffith, which then became a key centre, a nationally funded key centre for cultural and media policy, headed by Tony Bennett from the mid-1990s to when he left in 1998, and then directed by Tom O'Regan after that. So this was continuing work. It was certainly a continuity for me to be involved so strongly in those entities, because it enabled me from now back in an academic base to continue a politics and practice which had begun at the Communications Law Centre.
And you're at the Queensland University of Technology now, also in Brisbane, but a different university obviously from Griffith. And somehow there's another transformation that takes place, and this is where I'd like us to conclude, if you could bring us in a circle in one sense where we began.
Yes.
When cultural policy becomes too residually socialist and idealistic and hortatory for you, and instead mammon in the form of the creative industries and the bourgeois subject rears its head and you grasp it and you shake it and it shakes you, and it's a love affair that no one's been able to terminate. Even as some of us want you to go back to poetry, well, it seems that that world is forever shuttered to us.
Yes, well...
get out of that one if you will, young man.
That's what's usually called in the business a leading question. But
we're all frustrated failed lawyers, really.
Well, indeed. And there's also the response I often encounter, which is that everyone wants me to go back to the phase, before the phase that I am in currently, or perhaps to the original phase, whatever that is.
Well, we've left out the Christavan feminist phase of Stuart's writing, which many of us also deem to be of great importance. But in any event, yes.
Well, one of the things that gave me a strong impression of the limitations of cultural policy was the work that I did on diasporic media from the in the late 1990s and into the early 2000s, studying diasporic media in different cultural contexts in different parts of the world, but producing the book Floating Lives, the Media and Asian Diasporas, that I co-edited book with John Sinclair, where I worked on the Vietnamese diaspora with Tina Nguyen and other colleagues, worked on other major Asian diasporas, gave me a very strong empirical insight into where real cultural vitality was occurring at in places that were at the absolute margins of polities. These are not conventionally politically subaltern polities and practices, but they are very much at the margins of official government policy. In fact, for most of the people that we, practitioners, musicians, film, video makers, fledgling web users in the diasporas, the last thing that they wanted was government attention. There was no easy way to hypothesise that cultural policy could have any beneficial effect for them at all. for reasons that, you know, I won't go into in detail, but mostly had to do with the fact that most of the product that was being produced was close to boundaries of legality, and so in the absence of a strong broadcasting structure that valued or had a place for such niche content, there was very little that the state could do other than produce harassing copyright policemen. So that certainly gave me an insight into limits of cultural policy, but at the same time, we get what we started this conversation with, which was the cultural policy moment in the creative industries moment in Britain, where a range of new sectors are brought together, and there is a argument being made for the mainstream, the mainstream economic value, this of culture, culture, media, design, and so on. And now, this fits in with a lot of theoretical work that was going on, the Lash and Urey work in the mid '90s on the culturalisation of the economy. There's quite respectable sociological accounts that would provide some ballast for these kinds of arguments, but I'm also aware that they remain controversial on the left. What this meant for me was that it was a way of addressing some of the limits of cultural policy, while also beginning to connect up with a range of developments around digital culture, the web, that cultural policy simply had taken almost no account of, and was indeed probably rather anxious about. So that's where we begin to bring the circle back to its start, and to the questions that have I've been preoccupied with, I suppose, on and off for the last 10 years or so, and that is the providing an evidence base for the way in which these broader sociological claims about culturisation that I referred to earlier, the Lash and Urey arguments, for instance, actually play out in policy advocacy, the creation of spaces for digital innovation, and a conviction that that these have a genuine progressive value, even as many of their elements are emergent, only emergent at this stage.
Well, Stuart, thank you so much. I think we've really only turned the page, as it were, towards where you are and how you got there. So I'm hoping that you'll re-enter the pod soon in order to share with us some of your adventures over that 10-year period.
Thank you very much, Toby, and all the very best to all who listen and travel with this podcast.
There we are. Thanks, everybody. It's been great having you here.